What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Year of Plenty podcast, the show for all things real food and the processes that bring it to the table. As always, I'm your host, Poldy Wieland, and I hope you're all having an amazing week. The sun has really been shining here in the Driftless region of Wisconsin the last couple days, and you know, I don't know about you, but I am feeling the spring breeze in the air. And I cannot wait for the sun to come out more, you know, tank some sun, get some vitamin D, and just be out in nature. So in today's episode, I talked to Jennifer Cote, who currently runs a wild crafting business called Moose, Mushroom, and Mud out in British Columbia, Canada. I really wanted to have Jennifer on to have a conversation about how we can harvest sap from birch trees and use it in the kitchen. Now, Jennifer almost has a decade of experience in tapping birch trees. And let me tell you, talking to her really got me fired up for this year's foraging season. And I have a feeling that a lot of you listening right now are just as excited as me about this year's wild harvest. Now, I've been sitting down and, you know, reading up, kind of choosing what plants and mushrooms to put on my foraging list. And I've now decided that the first thing to harvest this year will be the birch sap here in a couple weeks. So this episode is quite timely in regards to that. And I hope it inspires some of you to really learn about the amazing birch tree and the sap that it provides. And if you're already tapping maple trees, but not birch, you should definitely listen up because you are missing out. Now for a quick episode overview, we first talk about Jennifer's background and journey into wild foods. Then we go over a detailed list of the equipment needed to really collect birch sap. Next, Jennifer gives us a complete rundown, a detailed rundown of how she harvests birch sap. Then we get into various ways of using this birch sap in the kitchen and turning it into a drink or food. You know, there's so many ways you can use it, which is really exciting, and you'll hear about that in this episode. And finally, we kind of diverge from foraging a bit because Jennifer's also a longtime hunter, which is really awesome. And, you know, I really wanted to hear her story about her first bison hunt. So at the end of the episode, she tells that whole story. And let me tell you, it was quite the experience. As always, this is the Year of Plenty podcast. If you enjoy it, smash that subscribe button on whichever platform you use to listen. Make sure to leave a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts. That's huge. That's one way that new people can find the show and that we can just connect with more foodies out there. Also, you can support it by making a donation on Patreon with the link in the podcast description. If you don't know, Patreon is a service that allows you to help me create the show with donations as little as $2 a month. And the cool thing about Patreon is that it's all based on the patronage system that was popular during ancient times. You know, back then, kings and queens alike used the patronage system to take creatives under the wing and support them in exchange for value. So if you do get a ton of value from the show, please consider making that small donation on Patreon. That just allows me to keep the lights on and, you know, allows me to keep pumping out more episodes. And let me tell you, more episodes are to come. I already have a lot more planned and several in the pipeline, so I'm really excited to share all those with you. Also, just sharing this podcast with people that you think are interested in these topics, you know, that's also a great help. So please consider doing that. Also, if you want to connect with me personally, the best way to do that is on Instagram. My Instagram is at Poldy Wieland. This is where I post a lot of additional free content that's supplementary to the show and just, you know, pictures and videos from my life, especially about my food journey, the wild food journey, all the outdoor activities I do. And of course, lately I've been posting videos about recent food news, just like kind of summarizing those food news for you so that you know what's going on in the world of food. Okay, that's it. Thank you so much for sticking around for the intro. Let's get started. Get ready to learn from Jennifer Cote. So Jennifer, great to finally meet you. You know, we've been chatting over Facebook a little bit here and there, but yeah, thanks for coming on the show. I'm really excited.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to talk to you today about a number of different topics, but I think our main topic will be birch trees and harvesting birch sap, which has, from what I've been reading about it, it's been a long tradition in a lot of European countries especially. And I feel like it's kind of been forgotten. You know, everyone always talks about maple, tapping maple trees, but I don't, at least down in Wisconsin here in the Midwest, I rarely hear anyone talk about birch trees. But before we get into all that, why don't you just introduce yourself briefly so the listeners know who you are?
Okay. I'm Jennifer. I live in northern BC in a town called Prince George, and I am a wildcraft guide. So I take people out on the land and teach them about the edibles and the medicinals around us, something that also has been forgotten by many people. And I found ever since COVID started, there's been a big resurgence of that, to have that self-sufficiency and that food security.
Absolutely. So how long have you been doing that?
The business is about 3 years old. But I mean, I've been dabbling in plants and medicines for learning about them probably for like the last 11 years.
Cool. Mm-hmm. And is that kind of how you got into the whole foraging side? Was it more so the medicinal aspect or the food aspect for you?
At first, is the food aspect. I've always picked berries when I was younger with my grandmother. And as I got older, about 12 years ago, my friend took me out to the bush, and she showed me fiddlehead ferns.
Love
the ostrich fern. Yeah. And she showed me the false Solomon seal. And she pretty much put them in my hand and said, "Here, these are edible. You can eat these." And as we were walking, I just saw so much more. And I'm like, okay, these are edible. And there's all these edibles around us. And I said, what else is edible? So that did start my journey. And so every year, I bought a bunch of guidebooks and just kind of studied and went out there into the field and just picked and gathered and compared, right? And just learned all the edibles on our land here.
Yeah,
it's very addicting.
It is. I was just about to say, for me, it's like that learning process is what gets me to come back every time. And obviously the stuff that nature provides, all the food ingredients, but it is really addicting. And I think it's a good addiction to have, for sure.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Especially if you start to get into like the mushroom hunting, I find it's like the ultimate Easter egg hunt for adults.
Yeah, right.
You never know where they're going to be, right? So, yeah.
It's also something to just that's someone that's easy for other people to get into that don't have any, you know, experience in any like outdoor activities like hunting, fishing, I think foraging is probably the best one for people to get started, the easiest one, just the lowest barrier of entries. What does make sense is to find someone who really knows what they're doing. That's probably the fastest way to learn, or it has been for me.
Yes. I come across that a lot where people feel intimidated. You know, when I first started, there was really no one to teach me. I did see a few elders in our area, and I went out with a few of them, which was very helpful. But I just wanted to know more. I felt like there was more. So I just kept studying the books and just comparing. If I was in doubt, like when in doubt, throw it out. And there was a lot of that over time until I got more confident in my skills. I'm very confident in my skills to become to the point where I'm a wildcraft guide. And a lot of people just say, can you take me out? Because it's too intimidating. I don't know what I'm doing, right? I need to see the plant. And so, yeah, that's where I come in.
Awesome. And yeah, you just mentioned elders. That's something I've always thought about, you know, what if I could meet some elders that have been doing this forever and maybe even know, you know, from their grandparents, like real ancient knowledge that we've largely forgotten. Was that pretty easy for you to find people like that? Because I haven't had too much luck.
Actually, it was a little bit easy because one of our schools that my kids go to, they were doing a nature walk and they found the elders. So I went on two walks with that they had an elder already. So I didn't have to go looking myself. I don't really quite know where they found them, but I was invited along. So
yeah, well, because, you know, today you can connect and stuff, things like forums or Facebook groups, but those people probably aren't using those technologies, so.
No, yeah. They might have went through maybe our university. I hear that a lot, so perhaps that they went that that way.
That's probably a good way to start. Yeah, universities, or maybe look for courses in the area or whatnot online. So besides foraging, how did you get into hunting and fishing? Was that something that just came naturally as you got into foraging?
No, I come from a family of hunters on my dad's side. So I grew up on venison. And when I was younger, I moved to Edmonton with my mother. And every summer we'd come back and see my dad. So there was really no hunting opportunities when I was young. Only when we came to visit him, where we fed venison. And then when I turned about 12 years old, I lived with him. I moved to locations, and that gave me the opportunity to go hunting with him. So every fall since I was 12 years old, I went hunting with my dad. And he was also he loved lake fishing. So I was probably into fishing more when I was younger, because every summer when I would come out to visit him, he would take us fishing, right? So I was introduced to hunting and fishing from a young age.
Awesome.
And I just, ever since I started hunting, my skills progressed. And my dad was really awesome for encouraging me to hunt and to go get my own game.
Yeah, that's something, I've been kind of hearing a lot from girls that are women that I talk to that have always kind of had an interest in hunting or fishing. And it's just been kind of discouraged by their family in the past. And I don't know why we have that kind of stigma in our culture, sadly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good to see, women like you who are out there also trying to get, bring food to the table. So I always like to see that. And I encourage everyone to just try it. I don't think it's just something that guys can do, obviously. So we were talking on Facebook a week ago or so, and you said that your pantry looks a lot different than a normal person's pantry. So what do you have in your pantry? What are some of the wild? I'm assuming it's a lot of wild food.
Yeah. Obviously, I have a lot of dried mushrooms, for example. What else do I have? I have a tea drawer that's full of the different herbs used for teas. Mm. I was thinking about this morning and now I'm kind of just totally blanked out. What else do I have? Oh, okay. Like pickled devil's club, pickled false salmon seal, pickled, fiddleheads that I have.
Love those. I made like 5 or 6 jars of those last year or last season. And yeah, those are incredible.
I know pickling is really fun. Cause even, I have a pickled daisy dill capers, which are like the daisy buds, the daisy buds off oxeye daisies, spruce tips, for example. So there's a lot of things that you can pickle out there, or just freeze in your freezer as well. It's another option. Cow parsnip. I have cow parsnip that's in the freezer. And what else do I have? Yeah.
Probably plenty of more things.
Yeah, exactly.
Point being that
I should have written it down.
It's all good. The point being that, I mean, you can get a lot from the wild. That's something I've kind of been expanding my skills too into foraging. I'm really surprised at how much out there is edible that I just didn't think of or had no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, as we, building those skills is super important. I think, as you said at the beginning, it's also addicting. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about birch, because that's one I kind of tried to, harvest some last year, some of the sap, and I just filled one water bottle just to try it out, really. And I was kind of late in the season already. But that really caught my interest. And so yeah, I'm excited to just talk about that, and maybe we can get into that now. How long have you been tapping the trees themselves? Not just birch, but trees in general.
I've just been tapping the birch tree, and I probably started about 7 years ago. So I haven't been doing it forever. Never tapped any other tree. Up here in northern BC, we don't have those sugar maples. We don't really have any maple species up here. And what we do have is a lot of birch. And this lady, she came up from Quesnel, and she owns Moose Meadows Farm. And she did a class up here. And of course, that was part of my foraging journey, and it fit in with my foraging journey. So I got to take this. So I went to the class and I learned how to tap birch trees. And the season was just basically 2 weeks away. So I made sure I had all the gear and went out and tested a few trees, and the sap was running. And I just started small, like 2 or 3 trees, and then just kind of went from there. And it was just a process of gathering the sap, drinking it, and then did gather enough to try to make some birch syrup. So that was pretty fun. And ever since then, I've been pretty hooked, and I've been pretty diligent at getting birch sap every year since then.
And you've also taught other people how to do it, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I think our forest is just so full of birch. There's so much out there. Why can't other people have this opportunity? Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's fun. And, you know, a lot of us foragers are kind of waiting until spring.
Yep.
In April, there's really nothing to forage. A lot of times the snow is gone, but there's nothing really to go out there. And so this is a great thing to fill that time until the spring edibles come up.
Absolutely. I think so too. Because, well, for us, it maybe starts a little earlier, you know, with foraging. Because, I mean, wild asparagus maybe, you know, ramps in April, it's still a little early for them, but during that, later in that month is usually when I start looking for those. But yeah, like you said, you know, it's just a perfect thing to start the foraging season, unless you're like getting maple, because I believe from what I've been reading that maple starts before birch, but we can get into the season, mm-hmm. all that in a sec. I'm just curious, were you hesitant the first time you tried the sap from a birch tree? Because, you know, one, I think it might be a strange thing for people. It was for me when I tried it the first time last year. I was definitely hesitant. And like I said, I just filled one water bottle and I drank a bit, and I'm always kind of careful when I try new wild foods. You know, some people are allergic to certain things, so I always just take it slow. And my buddy also drank from it, and we were fine, obviously. So still a little careful, but this year I'm really trying to get a lot. So were you hesitant the first time?
No.
Not at all.
I mean, no, based on, you know, the teaching of that that lady from Moose Meadows Farm, she's like, it's just like water. It has these vitamins, it has these minerals in it, amino acids, and it just will taste like cool, sweet, silky water. So I'm like, okay, I'm game for it, right? So I wouldn't say I chugged it back, but I wasn't hesitant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of like filled up the milk jug. I came home and I said to the family, I'm like, okay, here, drink this. It tastes good, right? Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's just, I don't think it's anything that people should be afraid of. And, you know, besides like all the minerals and vitamins, and we can get into that in a sec here, I actually found a really cool article I want to share about some of the nutritional value of birch water, birch sap. Also, I think, you know, a lot of people are getting interested in the whole gut microbiome and getting as many microbes out of their natural environment in them. And I feel like, you know, besides eating maybe some dirt when you're out picking mushrooms or some, you know, tubers like parsnip or something like that, this is probably another way to get some of those microbes in you, because in that whole process, you know, tree getting all that water from the ground and whatnot, and I'm sure some of that gets into that birch sap as well. I mean, it's just a guess, but
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of natural yeast that kind of float around in the air down there, and it's on the tree itself. And that's why over time, when you collect the birch sap, you'll find like a pink yeast eventually in your containers or in your tubes, or that white buildup that starts. And that's all that natural yeast and bacteria in there. And it's, as far as I know, it's not harmful. And I've consumed it many times. What happens if you get too much is just kind of like that fermentation or that sour taste. So it's not very pleasant, but a little bit has never harmed.
Yeah. So there you go. There's definitely yeast in there. That's a microbe. And I'm sure there's a bunch of other things.
Yeah, exactly.
So why birch trees? You know, why do you think that people should focus on birch versus, let's say, maple, or maybe, I know there's other trees you can tap. I still have to learn a lot more about that, but.
Yeah, I think it's because it's conducive to your environment, right? So if you're up in the north here and you have no maple,
yeah,
go for your birch. And you know, it's a spring tonic for us as well. It has a, you know, First Nations they would, you know, go through a long, typically harsh winter, right? Food stores are maybe coming down. They don't have that access to all that fresh greenery. So, you know, the sap was one of the first things that they would tap to, and it would replenish. It had enzymes and amino acids and vitamins and minerals, like I said, right? So that was kind of like their first dose of all this vitamins and nutrients, right? So yeah, so I guess it depends on your environment, and it's just kind of like this first boost of spring that you will get.
Yeah, it's a great way to connect with nature right after the winter. You know, maybe some of you have been, you know, stuck in your house all winter long. Maybe you don't like the snow, don't like coming out, but this is a great way to enjoy that spring right away. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, so you were just talking about the First Nations people, but I read a really interesting article called Uses of Tree Saps in Northern and Eastern Parts of Europe, and it's by Svanberg et al., and I'll be linking that in the podcast description. But it was several pages long, like a research article, and that was super interesting to kind of hear how much it was used in Europe and gathered mm-hmm. in Europe, because they didn't really focus on maple or anything. They focused on birch, according to this. And it's basically like a collection, this article, of ethnobotany and ethnography of a bunch of different northern, southern, and central European countries and cultures. So I took some notes. I just want to kind of like share my little summary of my notes here from this article, because I think people can really learn from it. So from what I learned there is that in Europe, the silver birch was actually the most popular one. And actually the experiments that they mentioned in this article also was that one has less sugar than other varieties, which, you know, I eat a low carb diet mostly. And I know a lot of people listening also aren't to low carb diets. So if you're a forager and you're not trying to get too many carbohydrates, this is okay to drink here. Also, it was used, like I said, throughout northern, central, eastern Europe. They mostly used it as a refreshing drink. They made it into wine, vinegar, mead, beer, even vodka in Estonia. Then it said they used it for dried, like they made a dried flour out of it. I'm not sure how that works. Maybe they like let the H2O evaporate, you know, so do you just have like sugar crystals or something left? But they also said they added them, like commonly added it to soups, porridge, and teas. And then they also made kvass. Have you heard of kvass?
No.
It's like, you know, a lot of fermentation craze around making your own sauerkraut and kimchi. But that's another one that a lot of people like to make. And it's another one of those fermented beverages, I believe. And, you know, there's beet kvass or rye bread kvass, where they actually used the rye bread as an ingredient. And I guess the birch sap was one that they would commonly add to it, as well as other grains. So they would actually take the birch sap and just add grains to it, like oats, barley, bread, and even dried fruits. Then, like you said, it was seen as like a natural medicine for a lot of these cultures, and was used against various health issues. We even have in this article, they had a ton of recipes and accounts from like people in medieval times talking about it, like all the way back to the 1400s, I think. So that I thought was really cool. That always gets me excited, you know, when it's something, when we actually have historical accounts of people using it that far back. And it was something used by like peasants, especially during the famines, but also like aristocrats and the nobles. So it was loved by all sides. Then it did say that a lot of the northern cultures, at least, you know, in like Finland and Sweden and Norway, they had actual like names for the month, like harvest, I guess for the harvest month of March or April, whenever it was in their area. They actually had like a name for specifically for that birch harvest.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I guess a big tradition all the way until the 1800s in Europe. Then it kind of, you know, throughout the beginning of the 1900s and throughout the last 100 years, it kind of died off, but it's starting to make a comeback, I guess. Yeah, and the Soviet Union was the largest commercial birch sap production. Like they went pretty hard with birch sap during their, you know, when they were around. So yeah, a lot here, but this was like probably a 20-page article, and I just wanted to share some of the highlights that I found were interesting. And then going into like the nutrition that you were talking about earlier, I found this Healthline article about birch sap. I'm just going to share the screen here quick, just so people can see. It's on healthline.com. I'll also be linking this one. It's called "What is Birch Water Benefits and Downsides?" Mostly what I thought was cool here is that they actually had, you know, like a nutritional values. I forgot where they got this from, probably from the USDA database. Yep. From the USDA database. It's always cool to me when they have, you know, when they have actual nutrition data of wild foods. But they say here that 300 milliliters, which is 10.2 ounces as a serving, is only 9 calories. So it's super low calorie. It's got 3 grams of carbohydrates. It's got a ton of magnesium, almost 100% of our daily value, and then a lot of manganese and some zinc. So I thought that was kind of cool to just see. I'm always interested in the nutritional value of things, you know. So yeah, and the manganese in there is one that I know. That's something. Have you heard of this? That the manganese in there might be an issue if you drink too much of it. You can get like a manganese toxicity.
No, I've never read that yet.
Yeah.
Have you?
I have, but it's just people were saying you would need to drink a lot, you know, and usually probably don't drink gallons of this. So,
no, I mean, I've known some people, like, as the season starts, like, I'll drink it on a daily basis for the 3 weeks that it runs. But I'm also sharing with my family. So I'm probably drinking 2 to 3 cups a day, right? I'm not drinking liters and liters of it for a day. And once the season's done, I'm pretty much done. I might freeze some in the freezer if I have room, a couple of milk jugs, empty milk jugs. Yeah, and then have it, pull it out once in a while, right? But yeah, so I'm wondering how much you would have to drink.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would be a lot, because I've heard of other people drinking it throughout the season as well. And with no issues.
Yeah.
Not to say that there can't be, but so far so good.
And most of my knowledge is all from reading stuff on. I always think, you know, having the real life experience like you, and then also, you know, talking to people who do it is definitely a better information. But yeah, that's a really good point. You know, maybe don't drink it, drink a ton of it every day during the season. Maybe just, you know, a couple glasses of it.
But yeah, maybe you're not doing like a cleanse with it.
Yeah.
Where you're drinking 2 liters a day every day, and you're having very little anything else with it, you know? So maybe not do that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So which species of birch do you tap? Because there's numerous out there, right?
Yeah. The most common tree we have up here is the paper birch, which is Betula papyrifera. Yeah, that's what we have up here. We have a few different other birch in the area, but that one's so abundant that on our crown land, that's what we find. There's some other birch, but they're mainly planted in town for ornamental. So that's what I am tapping, is the paper birch.
Have you tried any other?
No, because I really haven't had the opportunity to try a different tree. When I'm out there, I try to keep a lookout for different birch, but I haven't come across any.
Yeah.
I don't have any friends with other birch trees in their yard, so I haven't had an opportunity.
Yeah, I think the most that I've seen around here, also the paper birch and then silver birch. There's yellow birch, right? There's river birch. I think I found a chaga on a river birch once.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's even black birch. I mean, there's various types out there, but maybe stick to the ones like the one you're saying, paper birch, and then the silver birch was the one that I learned in my readings, was the one that they used the most in Europe, at least. And then, you know, obviously when people go out, they need to make sure they're identifying the right tree. I will link a video in the show notes too for IDing a birch. The only, really, I would say the only lookalike there is probably the aspen, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one that you can probably confuse a birch with. Can you think of any other trees?
No, not per se. Not here. So yeah, because we have the aspen, but their bark is not peeling. It's not papery.
That's the big differentiator, right? I think that most people can go to. I mean, an aspen bark will not peel, but I think every birch bark peels that I've seen so far.
Yeah, and with paper birch, I mean, it's named that for a reason.
Yeah,
right. A lot of their bark does peel back like paper. Sometimes the younger ones may not have that bark, but when you're looking for the paper birch to tap, you're looking for large diameter paper birch, and you'll see the bark peeling.
You read my mind. That was my next question. You know, how thick should the tree be? How big does that really play a role?
Yeah, I mean, based on what I've been taught and read, you're picking trees that are 8 inches in diameter at chest height. So it's a fairly large diameter tree. And then, I mean, I've measured, there's a few birch around here that are about 16 inches across sometimes.
Okay.
So you're looking for 8 inches and larger.
Yeah, the bigger trees then, mostly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think you want the young ones to grow and have the opportunity for later.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's a big part about foraging, I think, is the sustainability aspect, right? So, especially if you as a hunter-gatherer want to do this for decades, you know, and for the decades to come after you, it makes sense to think at least about the population of birch out there, because you are, I mean, by tapping, we are damaging them in a way, right?
Yeah, so a larger tree would be able to probably handle, you know, more stress or a wound, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then I guess we can get into that now, but you know, we'll get into the process in a sec here, but if you're making a hole in there or an incision, however you do it, do you afterwards close that up again when you're done extracting or collecting the sap? Do you do anything with the hole?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I normally take a birch dowel that you can buy at the hardware store. That's typically the same diameter of my hole, and I cut it down into pieces. It's about 2 inches long, and then I tap it into the tree to kind of plug it up, right? You can also take like a wine cork and whittle it down to the proper size and tap it into your tree. But I know a few people that they don't seal their holes, and they say nature will take care of itself. So,
and it might, you know, I mean, if the tree gets hurt in nature in any other way, it probably finds a way to heal that wound itself. But I do think, again, with the sustainability aspect, it makes sense to at least close those holes and make it a little easier on the tree.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it too. Yeah.
So when does the season start and how long does it usually last? You know, what kind of tells you that it's time to start preparing for the harvest and getting after it?
Okay. So around here, and probably would be the same for you guys, I'm looking for those days that are about warming up to 10 degrees Celsius. And what would that be for Americans?
You know, I'm from,
I have it somewhere.
I'm from Germany originally, so I still struggle with that.
Oh, okay. So
but I'm going to look it up
50,
quick.
50 degrees.
50,
so 50 degrees,
degrees
Fahrenheit.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was reading too.
Okay. Yeah. And when the nights are about that 0 degrees, which is 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And so I'm kind of looking for days like that. And you still have a lot of snow on the ground when that happens, right? Obviously. And so I'm often tapping when there's still snow on the ground. So I start looking for those days, those warmer days. And what's happening is the soil around the root system needs to get up to about 10 degrees, which is 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And that creates a pressure on the roots. And that what sends up this takes the sap and the nutrients up to the tops, right? So that what we're looking for is more of a root pressure with birch.
Yeah, so it's really dependent on that soil temp and the roots, like you just said. And the good thing is that, you know, people who might already be tapping maples, from what I was reading, they might want to keep their equipment out because the birch mm-hmm. literally starts right after the maple stops flowing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What's kind of the month for you? If you could, you know, obviously depends on the area. When would you roughly place it?
Yeah. So for us, it starts about the end of March. So it's coming up for us. And it runs for about 2 to 3 weeks on average. 1 year I did manage to get a month of tapping. So that was kind of awesome because I got so much extra sap out of that year, right?
That's a lot. Generally,
yeah, it is. It's but for say, I think it was 2 years ago, the sap run didn't start till April 12th, which is kind of late for us, and it only lasted for 2 weeks. So at that time, I'm kind of happy that I put out more buckets, like I tapped more trees to get the volume I wanted, because it was only a 2 week window for us. Yeah.
And so I'm guessing down here in Wisconsin, it's probably also late March, somewhere around there. I mean, as soon as it hits that 50 degrees, like you said, is that when you usually start going out to check trees, or how do you go about it? How do you kind of check if the sap, you just go and make a little incision, see if sap is flowing, or?
Yep. I will go to a tree that I have planned to tap, and I will actually drill a regular hole as I would for tapping. Because if it is running, I can put my spile in it. And if not, then I just kind of have to wait, right? So I just kind of watch that weather and the weather forecast. And I'm typically always jumping the gun. I typically always have a test hole and I'm waiting, right? Because I'm just excited. I want to get out there. And you think spring is coming. You think the soil must be warm enough, but it's not, right? So you wait a day, you wait a 2 days. Sometimes I've waited like an extra week, right? But I just leave that hole. I just leave it. And normally when I come back, I can see it starting to run down the bark, right? So
yeah,
so just go try it out, right?
It's got to be exciting when that first, when you see that first sap flowing. I've been really thinking about it a lot the last couple of weeks, and this year I think I'm gonna try to get several gallons. So let's get into equipment. I mean, what is kind of needed to get the sap and bring it home?
So you typically need your tapping supplies, which includes a spile, a tap, a hose, a bucket or a container to collect it. A drill and a drill bit. I like to use a closed system. Like I don't like to do it where they have the maple tap and the little tiny metal bucket. I don't like that. Birch trees are really, really, really messy. You know, the slightest breeze sends down debris like lichen and birch bark and everything. So I like to keep my system closed.
So I'll have by closed, spile. You mean like an actual lid on the container?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the spile is hooked into the tree. And then my hose fits on the spile and that goes down into a lid and that covers my bucket. And so nothing is just falling into it. And there's no insects or rodents getting into my product, basically, right?
Nothing better.
Closed system.
Nothing better than a mouse or a chipmunk in your birch sap, right?
Well, you'll be amazed how often sometimes, you know, I have a closed system, you know, I'll come back to collect my sap and I still have debris in
really?
My, yeah. And I think that's due to either one, I'm not closing my lid properly, or, you know, we get into this habit of taking the lid off and placing it on the ground. Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's still snow there, but the snow is dirty, you know, so we don't think about it and we pick back up our lid and put it back on. Right. So I think that's where it's really coming from. I'm not being careful enough. But that's where you would have your extra equipment is like a filter, like a coffee filter or a piece of cheesecloth.
So you would run it through that before processing it or using it.
Yeah, if you want to. I mean, I've drank
debris
before. It's not a big deal.
Again,
so.
Just more microbiome there, right?
Yeah.
A little bit more. It can't hurt too much.
Yeah, so your spile, your hose, your container, your drill bit. I like to have a mallet to, you know, tap my taps in. I personally like to use, so there's different types of spiles, right? And there's these black L-shaped spiles that you can buy online. And generally they work out. I tend to have them like, so for some reason break on me. So I don't like to use them. I tend to use a I go to the plumbing section of a hardware store and I buy, they're called like a hose mender or hose splicer, right? And they're small and they're about a 3/3 of an inch or 5/16, I believe, right? So stainless steel, I like to get stainless steel because birch sap is a little bit acidic, right? So if your sap is running through your spile, it will, and it's like say brass, there's a lot of brass fittings out there, it'll kind of eat away at that over time, right? So I like to buy the stainless steel ones and use those.
And, what about plastic? Yeah, have you used plastic at all? Is that an issue?
No, I haven't used plastic. They do have the hose menders in plastic, but I find that they're really large diameter. Mm. And I'm trying to keep that diameter small to make a smaller wound on the tree.
Yeah, that's okay.
So that's why I go with the stainless steel ones, and because they're smaller and they will last. They will last, right? I know they won't break in the tree as well. The only thing is, I find them more economical to buy as well. The only thing is, you'll need a pair of pliers at the end to get them out of the tree, right? Mm. Those L-shaped black spiles, you can kind of like use anything to pry them out of the tree. But with the hose menders, just a straight tube with kind of barbs on either end. And so you'll need a pair of pliers to get that out.
And how do you match your drill bit to the spile? Is it just, do they come in pretty standard sizes, you would say?
Yeah, they do. So when you're at the plumbing section, you can just, they'll say what type they are, and then you can go get a drill bit that corresponds with that. And a lot of times, like even your tubing. So if I have a 3/8 hose mender, I can go buy 3/8 clear vinyl tubing that's food grade, typically in the same aisle. Mm. If you have your spiles, even your spiles are set up with a lot of different drill bits. So you just take a look at your spile. Okay, it says 5/16 or 7/16, and then you would just get the according drill bit.
Yeah. Perfect. And how big are the containers that you get? You know, what should people be kind of expecting in terms of sap per tree?
Yeah, okay. So on average, a tree will produce about 4 liters a night, okay, or 4 liters a day.
So a little bit more than a gallon, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like gushing out. Yeah, like a gallon. I've seen a few trees produce more than that, and I've seen trees produce half of that.
Okay.
So it kind of depends on what you want to. Like I know some people that only want the sap, and so they just use gallon milk jugs to collect it. Myself, I'm using 5 gallon buckets, food grade buckets. And the reason I do that is because I'm not checking my sap every day. I'm checking it every second day. Mm. And then what I do, and I transfer it into another container to bring it out of the bush. The one thing with that though, it gets really heavy. You're carrying a bunch of liquid, right? So if I'm collecting sap from 8 trees, I'm going to be carrying out maybe 2 to 3 to 4 extra 5 gallon buckets. So that's part of your equipment as well. So not only do you need containers, you know, often need something to transfer your sap in.
Okay. Right? And then you just keep it out there and wait for more to flow basically.
Yep, exactly. I just transfer and then walk out. You'll get to a point, maybe about the second or third weekend, you'll find that your hose starts to get like maybe like a white sludge on the inside, or you'll find that your buckets will start getting kind of a pink rim. And that's that natural yeast starting to grow and build, right? So either switch out your hoses. If the season's not done yet, switch out your hoses as clean ones, or bring new buckets, or bring something to clean and sterilize your bucket again.
Cool. And
that will happen.
You mentioned the acid and you know, using the stainless steel. So your buckets are plastic, though. They're like food grade, and you haven't had any issues with that at all.
No.
Yeah.
I've reused them year after year, right? So.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So yeah, we just mentioned like, you know, little bits and pieces of your process, but you think you can just kind of run us through the process, you know, from start to beginning?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, sure. I can. So maybe a week before I think that the sap is going to run, I go out and get all my equipment from my storage room there, and I bring it inside. It's been sitting there for pretty much, you know, 11 months, I guess. And I bring it inside and I dump everything into my bathtub. And then I fill it all up and put some bleach in there and I sterilize everything, make sure everything is clean and ready to go, right? And this really annoys my family because they're out of a bathtub for about, you know, however long I decide to keep them in there. And then when I'm ready, you know, I take the gather up everything and take it out to my vehicle. I normally bring a sled and I normally bring snowshoes, right? And then I go out to my location and put my snowshoes on and put all my gear on the sled because I'm normally still, it's still 3 feet of snow generally.
Wow.
So if you tried walking into the birch spot, you're without snowshoes. Like, and because that snow is melting, I am normally sinking down to my knees, right? So it's really hard to walk in that snow. So just bring snowshoes.
So it's also a workout on top of all the nutritional benefits.
Yeah, exactly. So especially where you decide to tap, like I've been in a few places where, you know, you got to think about your route, right? Because you're going in there and you have to bring out all these heavy containers, right? So I have a deep sled now and I have bungee cords. So I got up to my location and, you know, I pick my trees. And as I'm looking at my tree, I'm looking for my eight inch diameter trees. And I'm trying to find some that are kind of grouped together. I don't want to have to walk too far between my trees. One thing I really do look for though, which helps, is if you can get a group of trees that all come up from the same base, I find those produce the most sap.
Pro tip here.
Yeah. So if you have something like six birch trees and they're all coming out of the same spot, you know, I pick maybe two or three of the biggest ones and I tap them. And sometimes they're like, I almost call them gushers. Mm. They tend to not have that four liters a night. They're tending to have, you know, six, right? So I like to hit those trees if I can.
So you just pick like out of those array of trees, you pick the ones with the most diameter, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And sometimes all of them, like sometimes I've been to a group of trees where, you know, all four or five of them have been eight inch diameters, right? Or more.
So and I then just you would use tap them all. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. I tap. Yeah. So it's pretty awesome. And you also got to think about where you're going to place your containers on the ground, you know, because that snow is going to melt and it can knock over your buckets. And that's why having that close system is really good. So if you're so anything tips over, you're not going to lose all your stuff. And also like to have longer hoses as well, because as that snow melts and that hose will stay into that container. So you got to kind of think about placement of how uneven is the ground, you know? Sometimes you might want to bring straps to actually strap your container to the tree, depending where it is, right? Because sometimes I'm tapping birch on a hillside, for example. Mm. So after I find my tree, there's a little bit of a trick. So you follow a root where the root comes up into the tree and you tap above that root or where that root is. Cause you know that where that root is bringing up sap, right?
Yeah. So you basically look for the parts of roots sticking out, and that's kind of the line you follow as you try to go up. You said chest high, right? Chest high is where you make the hole. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You'll see that root coming up into the tree. Yeah. And just go about chest high and then pick your spot. Right. And then you typically drill on a slight upward angle, about 10 degrees and about 2.5 inches deep. Hmm. And if you don't know what that is, just get a Sharpie and mark your drill bit. So you're only going in that far.
Oh yeah. That's a good tip. Yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes you're drilling, you're like, did I drill like, you know, 3 inches in? Not deep enough. It's not deep enough. It won't, you know, it won't get to the inner cambrium where that sap is flowing. So, you know, mark it and then you tap your spile in and then you attach your hose. And you'll see too, like you'll see the sap. Once you drill, you'll see the sap start pouring out, not pouring. It seems to come out really fast at the beginning. Right. It's just like drip, 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 drip. Right. And you're like right on. Right. So you put it in, but after it actually, it kind of drips. What was this? One drip per second. So it's actually quite slow. Right. That's why it takes so long to get 4 liters. Yeah, so it will slow down actually up that first initial drill. And then you just set everything up, your hoses in your bucket, and then you leave. And then you can either choose to come back the next day or every second day. So it depends on the size of your containers. And time, if you have the time.
Yeah, absolutely. What's like the longest you have not gone back to the to check on the sap? Do you have like a strict schedule where you're like every 2 days for sure I'm going out there?
No. Life happens, right? So I think the longest time one time was about 4 days. Hmm. So, and my buckets were full. Like they're up to the brim typically. So I don't normally have enough containers to transfer every, if I tapped 8 trees and they're full, I have to have 8 containers. Right. So that was kind of a mistake, but life happens. But the sap was still clear, right? Cause it's sitting in snow. The nights are still cool. Right. And the days are maybe reaching 10. Right. So the sap was fine. The problem with that after though, is like you have all that sap coming home with you. So say if you have 8 5 gallons, so how much is that? 40 gallons worth coming home, for example, you have to process all that. So you have to make sure you have the time to process that or to freeze it or to drink it. You know, I know quite a few people that can gather lots and they just give away a lot of sap because they can't keep up with it.
Yeah, that's the beauty of one of these, of this type of foraging, I guess. It's like I always like to look for those kind of plants and mushrooms that produce a ton, so I can also give some to friends and kind of introduce them into the world of wild foods, you know.
Yeah, and then, it's fun to share.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. So really the sap, when it comes out, it should look clear. Is that kind of what you were getting at?
Yep. Yeah, it will look pretty much crystal clear.
What about like taste? Have you ever just sampled it, you know, out there as it's coming out?
Yes. I normally have a tin cup with me when I go up there, so I can just kind of scoop it from my bucket and have a drink, right? And typically the taste is just, it's cold because it's been sitting out there, but it's kind of this cool, it's almost hard to explain because it's cool and crisp, yet smooth and silky, I guess you can say. And it's slightly sweet. It's not really sweet, but sometimes it's just slightly sweet. You'll drink it and you'll be like, yes, it's water, but there's something a little bit to it.
And yeah. Yeah.
It's just overall very, very refreshing.
That's right? Kind of last year when I tried it for the first time, it kind of seemed like it looked a little thicker than water. Maybe I don't know if it just looked like that, but a little bit more syrupy to me. Maybe it was also because I got it pretty late in the season, but it was super refreshing and just slightly sweet. I kind of compared it to coconut water, but better. I thought it was better.
Yeah. It's, you kind of got to remember, it's like 99% water and maybe 1% sugar, vitamins and minerals, right? Like the average, our birch trees produce anywhere between 0.4%, 0.04% sugar to up to 2%. Sugar, whereas compared to a maple tree might produce 5%. And on average around here is typically like 1% that I read. So it's very, very low percent in sugar. So it really shouldn't change the consistency of the water. So it should just feel and taste and look like water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And have you noticed that maybe color or texture changes throughout the season? You know, I kind of thought that maybe because I got it later in the season, it might have seemed a little bit more syrupy to me. Maybe it was just, you know, just a kind of maybe like visually it tricked me a bit. But have you noticed that it kind of changes the texture?
I find like late season. So basically what happens is your sap is running up the tree for a couple of weeks and it's starting to bring nutrients to the tops and to every single twig. And it starts to form leaf buds, right? So when those buds start to develop, they actually capture sunlight and everything, and they start bringing stuff back down. And that's when that texture starts to change. So sometimes on the last maybe 2 or 3 days, my water will start to look slightly cloudy, but it still tastes good. Like there's something a little bit off about it, but it's not off-putting. So I can still drink it. And then it gets to a point where, okay, now it's full on opaque. And you can definitely taste that sourness. It's not that it's fermented. It's just that they're sending a whole bunch of stuff back down. So different nutrients are coming down. And so it definitely tastes different and not that refreshing taste anymore. So that's kind of like when you know the seasons is done. But you can get like 2 or 3 or 4 days where it's just slightly different. And that's because it's starting to send different nutrients back down the tree.
Interesting. Yeah. See, that's just someone who starts out. Those are really valuable insights there. So don't worry if your sap, if you're getting there a little late and the sap is a little cloudy. But when you kind of like know it's, does it just stop flowing? I'm guessing it doesn't, right? Because I mean, it's always...
Yeah, it won't stop flowing. It will just turn opaque. Like you'll have your container and it'll look like water, watered down milk, maybe, I guess you can say. It will look white and it will look opaque.
So when you get too much of that, you know, okay, now stop.
And you'll notice the taste too. It's different. It's definitely different. It's not that refreshing coolness anymore, right? So that's when you know to wrap things up.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, cool. Well, thanks for that detailed description of your process. You know, that's definitely going to make it a lot easier for me this year. What about, you know, what do you make out of it? You kind of mentioned that you just drink it plain. That's something I think that a lot of people, from what I was reading, that's how a lot of people like to use it, just like as a fresh, refreshing drink. You mentioned you freeze it. How do you kind of like to use the birch sap?
I like to use it pretty much wherever I would use water in that next 2 to 3 weeks, right? So if I'm making a soup, okay, and put the birch sap in the soup. I like to make like refreshing drinks out of it. Like one of my favorites to do with it is often I have dried stinging nettle in the cupboard. So I'll often make stinging nettleade for the family.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah. So instead of using water, use your birch sap and, you know, simmer some stinging nettle in it and add some honey or your choice of sweetener. And it feels like spring. It feels like a spring drink that you're drinking, right? I also like to make wine with it, birch sap wine. And I call that my healthy wine just because it's having that extra nutrients in it. Most of them don't get destroyed. Like, you know, the minerals wouldn't get destroyed in it, right? But yeah. Maybe I'm just using that as an excuse, but I do like birch sap wine.
So is that, when you use the birch sap wine, are you literally just replacing the water you would use when you're making like a fruit wine with the birch sap? Or are you just adding a little bit of it? Okay, so you totally just replace it.
Totally replace it. Like, I actually get a Ubrew place to make it. I just don't have time to make my own wine. And so they typically say, okay, you need 20 liters of birch sap. And then I would take it in and then we discuss, okay, what flavor do you want your birch wine to be? If it's a white wine, they'll add white grape must. If it's a red wine, they'll add red grape must to it. If it's a fruit wine, okay, they will add raspberry puree to it if you want, right? Plum puree, peach puree, you know? So you have all these different fun options to play with when you make wine.
Yeah, I read about several different recipes where it seems like the pattern I saw was that traditionally people would add like tart or citrusy fruits to it. Either, you know, different berries, raisins, lemon peel was one that always showed up. There was one medieval recipe that talked about lemon peel and cloves. I think it was like from the 1600s. So it still count. I believe that still falls under medieval times. But So is that anything you've ever tried adding in?
No. I don't think I've ever looked at traditional uses or like how to make traditional wine out of birch sap. When I first kind of looked into it, it was more like, so birch sap has quite a bit of tannins in it. So it would pair well with a white grape concentrate, for example. So I'm like, oh, okay, sure, why not, right? So that's what I tried. But I did not dive into more I guess, traditional uses of what they used to do in Europe and everything, right? I've just kind of always just wanted to do my own thing.
Yeah, experimenting. Hey, that's all we do. Like me and my friends, that's all we do. You know, we try to follow recipes, but in the end of the day, we often just experiment and see where it goes. That's also a fun part of it, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes there's just not enough time in a day to try everything. And, you know, like the lemon and clove, what you just said sounds really intriguing to me now, right? So now I'm going to have to take a look in that. And I have a group of people that often will make birch sap wine, right? And we kind of all trade, but we've never really done anything too different, like adding clove, for example, right? So it might actually maybe extend our palate this season. Try something different.
Absolutely. And it's just interesting that you can add all those different flavors and just create, you know, a bunch of different end products. And that's something that's interesting to me about making wine or even beer and all that. You know, in Germany, for example, people are really strict with their beer because the laws tell you that you can only use three ingredients or whatever. You can't, you know, there's no like craft beer and stuff like that. But the more I read into history and how people have used, like, made brewed beer, made wine in the past, it seems like they were always adding a bunch of different flavors to it. It wasn't just always a pure thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's fun to add a bunch of different flavors. There's so many different things out there. Why not try something out, right?
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, it's all about time. You would probably want to make with a small batch at first. If it doesn't work out, well, that'd be too bad. You know, 30 bottles of wine that you can't use anything.
Yeah.
Can't drink it, right? Yeah.
And so you bring it to a place and they usually do it for you then? Is that what you were saying at the beginning?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever tried or heard of anyone making mead?
No, not around here. I kind of looked into it once and I would like to do that one day. But again, it kind of comes down to that availability of time. I'm having trouble with that word today, with time constraints. How about let me say that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you?
No, I haven't. I mean, like I said, I just got that bottle last year, but that's, I think, what I'm going to try this year more mainly is the mead. So for people mm-hmm. listening who don't know what mead is traditionally, like a traditional mead is just like a fermented water with honey. And then, you know, ferment it with yeast. And here again, from what I was reading, people would use the honey and then instead of the water, they use the birch sap and they just ferment that. And that is really intriguing to me. Maybe I'll add some cloves and lemon peel even. But then again, you know, there's some people that to preserve the birch sap, they literally just ferment it by itself with a couple ingredients. Like I watched a video 2 days ago, I think, where a guy, he literally just took the birch sap, put it in like fermenting containers, added, I think, raisins and some dried fruits and sugar, and then he just let that ferment by itself. So, you know, not necessarily making like a wine, but just fermenting that birch sap by itself. And I guess then you can keep it for longer. I'm not sure how long exactly, but that's something I was also reading a lot in these historical accounts is that people would just put the sap by itself into wooden barrels and ferment it with a few other ingredients. But the main ingredient in there was the birch sap.
Very fascinating.
Yeah.
I definitely need more time in a day to do all this.
Right.
I would love to learn. And if you end up making any of that mead, you're going to have to send some up. Okay.
Oh, okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll send the recipe for sure. Maybe
if it's good.
If I don't drink it all by myself by then.
Yeah.
But so you did mention you made syrup out of it too, right? At one point.
Yeah.
And is that worth it? Would you say?
Yes, I would. It's a labor of love, right? I mean, ever since I started making syrup, I do it every year. And sometimes I ask myself, like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? It's a lot of work, but I can't help it because I love having that extra, product in my pantry.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, have a guest over. It's like, okay, for dessert, you have your ice cream and then you can top it with birch syrup, right?
Absolutely.
Or we're having a brunch, right? Okay, let's put birch syrup on our pancakes, right? So I just love having that opportunity to have it around, right? So I do it every year, and I love it, and yet it's a love-hate relationship because it does take a lot of time. And if you ever make birch syrup, I think you all understand what I mean about that.
Is it different than making maple syrup, or same process basically?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same process, but I think it's a little bit longer because, for example, you know, maple syrup takes 40 liters. You have to evaporate 40 liters to get 1 liter of maple syrup.
Which that's crazy by itself, that you need that much, right?
Exactly, right? And whereas birch is 80 to 100 liters.
Holy shit, that's a lot more.
It is, so it depends on kind of your sugar content that's coming up into your sap. That's why, for example, if your sugar content of your tree is 0.04%, can you imagine how much you're actually boiling away to concentrate those sugars? So sometimes you can actually, when you drink your sap, you can kind of tell that there's a little bit of a higher sugar content because you can actually taste more of the sweetness. Whereas other trees that I've tapped can taste pretty plain, right? And I find that varies from year to year with the sugar content. Like one year in the same spot, I tapped 6 trees and I had to have 100 liters to make that 1 liter. Whereas the following year, for some reason, the sap was a little bit sweeter and I only needed 80 liters to make that 1 liter, right? So for some reason, it varies from year to year. But yes, you do need, you're evaporating a lot more to get that 1 liter.
Yeah, that makes me almost like wonder if it's worth it. I think I'm mostly going to stick to drinking just the sap this year and making that mead. Maybe though, maybe I'll try and dabble with the syrup. We'll see.
It is fun. I think if you don't have to make a liter. You don't have to make a liter of syrup too, right? You can just boil enough to make maybe 250 mils.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So start small. I definitely should mention that. Start small, and then you can kind of get an idea what it takes, right? And then, you know, sometimes people have frozen, you know, large buckets for it, and then tried it at a different time, right? Myself, I have deemed. So you got to think kind of about like your fuel costs as well. So when you make syrup, are you going to use propane? Are you going to use electricity, natural gas? Are you going to use a wood stove, right? Now, commercially, people have a sugar shack, right? And however they do it, whether or not it's wood fed and there's evaporators on top, maybe they have a reverse osmosis machine, if it's just you, what are you going to use, right? And in my area, propane can be, you know, expensive, or natural gas can be a little bit expensive. So I found out that the cheapest way for me to make my birch syrup is to use electricity. So I bring in my stainless steel stock pot and I put it on my stove inside my house. And a lot of people are like, what are you doing?
Because most pictures I've seen of people doing maple syrup, it's big containers outside over fires.
Well, yeah, exactly. And when you have it outside over fires, you got to think about, you have to have that wood available and you have to keep feeding it, right? Yeah. I don't want to do that, right? Commercially, maybe. But if I'm only trying to make 3 liters, my goal is 3 liters of syrup a year. I keep one or two for myself and the rest is shared and given away as gifts, right? It's like a little bit of liquid gold. So a lot of people appreciate that. But the condensation in the house is massive. So I just say, open up your doors, you know, springtime, open up your doors, open up your windows, right? And put your fans on. And then a lot of that condensation can be blown out, right? So to me, it's not the worst thing in the world if I do it inside. I just keep the windows open. It is a little bit of a detriment though, because a lot of that water, you know, it boils and some of it's falling out of the pot and landing onto your stove. So I have kind of ruined the finish on my stove. But that's okay. It's not a big deal to me.
Everything for that liter of birch syrup.
Right, exactly. So, and that's on a coil top. And you'll have challenges if you just have a glass top, like ceramic. They don't recommend putting those large pots. They're heavy, right? So that's something you have to consider as well. What kind of a stove top do you have? Maybe you can get a coil top, which they're hard to find. They're not really making them anymore, right? It's all about the glass top or natural gas. And natural gas would work well too. But maybe you can put that outside. Maybe you have an extra one. Maybe you can put it outside in a garage, for example, right? So if you're worried about condensation in your house, right? So just kind of like try to find solutions to how you to these issues, right? Like if you don't want to ruin your finish on your stove, don't boil it in the house on your stovetop, right? If you're worried about condensation, open up the windows or, you know, have it outside somewhere, right? Your cooktop somewhere. So I do it every year. I find with condensation, some of the biggest things in my house is, you know, Prince George is a very dusty place. So it gets all over the walls over the years. So, you know, after I'm done birch tapping, I'm typically cleaning my walls because you'll see all the little dirt that streaks down after a while, right? So it's a benefit. I get to clean the house, I guess. So
what I hear you say is no excuses.
No excuses.
Making that birch sap.
Exactly. Figure out how you're going to cook it down, because having that syrup, like I said, it's kind of like liquid gold, and it's pretty impressive when, you know, somebody says you made that. You know, you boiled how much water, like how much birch sap to get that, right? The biggest thing though about making birch syrup is the finishing. You have to babysit it, because if it burns, all that work is for nothing.
That's a really good point. So you really just probably stand there and watch it.
Yeah, I have the timer on, you know, I get to a certain point. So I have my pot, right? And it's boiling and boiling and the water is reducing. The sap is reducing, and I'll take more sap from the bucket, place it in, top it off. And I just keep, and it keeps coming down, and I just keep adding. Eventually I get to a point where it's quite getting really quite dark, and then I'll transfer into a smaller pot and finish it. Or sometimes I'll even transfer it into my crock pot and put it on high to let the evaporation do more evaporation, right? But whatever, however you do it, you have to babysit it.
Okay.
So it does not burn.
Yeah, that's good to know. What about just storing the plain fresh sap in the fridge? How long do you usually keep it in there?
Until it lasts for about 5 to 7 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then does it, I've read that it kind of ferments by itself and it gets a little sour.
Yeah, it gets sour. Like, yeah, you'll kind of take a swig of it and you're like, oh, okay, this is done, right?
And it's probably when you get to vinegar eventually right there. So maybe
I actually do want to make the vinegar one day. I did last year. I did take some birch sap and did make a sourdough starter out of it.
Really?
You know, because it has that some natural yeast in it already. So I wanted to try that out. So, and it worked out pretty good.
How did you go about that?
Well, just pretty much like when you make a sourdough starter, it's pretty much your water and your flour, and then you let it sit on your counter until it starts to ferment, right? So pretty much instead of using water, I just used birch sap.
Cool. And you didn't add any yeast or anything. Yeah.
No.
Wow. That's cool. And it worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it different from another regular, like a sourdough starter? I don't know. I just like the fact that I had one more use for my birch sap. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it had its own different yeast in it, and whatever yeasts are in it did work. Right. Yeah, because sometimes you can get wild yeast that, you know, do not ferment well or contamination, for example. But this one didn't. It made a sourdough starter.
Awesome. Yeah. No, that's good to know too, because like you said, you know, we might have a ton more sap. Maybe you're not making syrup. So what do you do with all that sap? You know, try to find interesting ways of using it. Yeah, I'm definitely also looking forward to adding it to maybe like a soup or a tea, you know, maybe even coffee. I don't know. I feel like you can get really creative with this.
You could, like I said, wherever you use water, use your sap instead, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
make some of that stinging nettle aid if you can.
Yeah. So for that one, you just literally dry the stinging nettle, the leaves.
Yeah. So in the springtime and summer, you're going to gather your stinging nettle and then you're going to dry it. And then you're going to keep some, you know, till next spring. So just so you can make your stinging nettle aid.
And then you just literally, are you boiling it though with the stinging nettle in there like you would a tea, and then let it cool back down? Okay.
Yeah, just let it cool. I like to use a lot. Like I like when I'm done with my stinging nettle light, it should look fairly green, okay. Right? And it should taste like stinging nettle. And so I use quite a bit, maybe say for example, to a gallon of birch sap, I'm probably using a cup of stinging nettle. So it is quite strong, but I love the taste of it. And then you add your sweetener to desired sweetness.
Right? Yeah. The stinging nettle is interesting in flavor too. That's when I kind of, you know, just tried every now and then over the last couple years. But last season, I definitely gathered a lot, and especially like when they were still really young. And I was using them in soups, you know, just like I would use spinach in a skillet or whatever. I mean, it's a really versatile plant that a lot of people overlook, I think.
Oh, yeah. And it's so good for you, right? So everybody should have stinging nettle in their pantry.
Yeah, agreed. Mm-hmm. Cool. Wow. Oh, the one more thing I wanted to ask about birch, though. So we mentioned freezing. Is that a good way to do it, to preserve it at all? Like, have you noticed that freezing it kind of changes the flavors maybe? Or is there, when you freeze meat or some plants, it changes texture and you can get freezer burn and whatnot. Is that an issue here?
No, I've never really found anything that changed the flavor or the taste. When you do thaw it out, probably shake it up after, right? Because what happens, some of those sugars, they freeze, but they sink to the bottom of the container.
That's okay? A good point.
Yeah, so make sure you shake it up. Yeah.
And then also,
for consumption,
I'm guessing when you put it in the container, leave a little headspace because, you know, when you freeze it, the expansion happens.
Yeah, it's going to act like water. So if you don't give it enough space, your container is going to burst apart, right?
Yeah. Have you ever tried just canning straight up the birch sap, not the syrup?
No. I've been thinking about that. I want to do it. I just haven't had the time to do it. This year, I might be doing that this year, though. So if I do it, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
Now, I think it would be a great way to preserve it and to have it in that long-term storage. Because like in my freezer, I have like three freezers and I never have any room in them. So canning birch sap would be just a great alternative to having it in the freezer, taking up room, right?
Yeah, you want the meat to be in the freezer, most of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just something I was reading about, and I mean, when you're canning, you are heating it up to like certain temperatures, but I don't think that's going to damage anything or, you know, especially since none of the water can evaporate out. It should be totally fine. So why not try it?
Yeah. And I mean, even if you lose some of maybe the enzymes break down when you heat it, right? There's still so much goodness in that sap. It's still worth having than not having it.
Absolutely. See, now I'm thinking of using it to, instead of water when I'm making my pickling brines and whatnot for fiddleheads and ramps. And I think I'm going to be using this birch sap quite a lot this season. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Nice. Yes.
Cool. So, I mean, wow, we got really in depth with the birch here, which is awesome. Thanks for sharing all that. Is there anything you think we didn't cover birch wise?
Let me just quickly take a look. It's kind of what you sent me. Kind of talk about collecting it, then uses and the syrup and the wine, you know. I definitely recommend if you're a wine drinker, you should try it.
And making your own wine really isn't that difficult. I'm still a beginner. I'm not saying that I'm good at it, but the process itself isn't that difficult. I think you just get better with more experience as you do it.
Mm-hmm. I guess one thing we kind of didn't talk about, like I guess the sustainability issues of harvesting the sap. And in my experience, I haven't really come across any. Like, I know you can tap a tree multiple times over the years, right? But eventually you have to stop tapping that tree, otherwise you're going to girdle it, and girdling will kill a tree, right? Now if you're a commercial birch producer, what you're going to do is you might tap it for so long, and then you might be cutting down that tree and make it into firewood, right? So it's not necessarily a negative thing if you're going to tap it. Maybe you, it all depends on your land use plan, I would have to say, right? But if you're just a regular person like me and I'm tapping on my friend's property or I'm tapping on Crown land, then I don't want to kill that their trees, or I'm not allowed to go kill a live tree, right, on Crown land. So I'm going to be more careful with it. I might just tap it for 4 or 5 years halfway around the tree and then stop, right? And then move on to the next tree because, well, I mean, out here, there's a lot of birch out here. So there's no reason why I have to girdle a tree and kill it.
So yeah. When you have a tree that you realize that it produces a lot of sap, do you kind of expect it to do that again the next year?
Yeah, that's what I would expect, but it's not always the case for some reason.
Yeah.
Like I said, sometimes 1 year had more sugar content than the year before, right? So sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm going back to this tree and it's going to be awesome. And instead of that 6 liters, I got 4 liters.
Yeah. And then also if you're in an area like you said, I mean, you guys probably have a ton of birch where you are at.
Oh, we have a lot. Yeah. So the paper birch is very, very abundant here. We have stands of it, you know, and then in mixed with the aspen, you know, a pioneer species as well. So, you know, if any of the land got damaged from before, that's one of the kind of the first things that start to pop up, right? Around Prince George, back when they're building the city, of course, there was a lot of clear cuts and land use. And some of those places were just allowed to grow back. And now we have, you know, 80-year-old stands of birch. So
wow.
I go tap them, right?
Yep. Why not? I have to go scout for birch here where I'm at. I have to like actually go deep into the forest and find them.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, if you find a stand, you might want to guard it.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. I don't think I'll have too much competition here, honestly. Like I said, most people are just... I've barely heard of anyone tapping birch, and that's another reason I wanted to talk to you today, because you know, like you said, there are areas where that is, you know, the opportunities there for it, more so maybe than maple. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for sharing all that with us. That was super interesting. So why don't we pivot a bit? Because I read you have a blog. What is that called again?
It's called Moose, Mushrooms, and Mud.
And for people listening, definitely check that out. I really like some of your stories. I actually read a couple of them. And the one that really caught my attention was you writing about preparing for a bison hunt. Mm-hmm. And that's one type of hunt I've always looked forward to in the future. I haven't started applying anywhere yet for any tags or whatnot. Probably should, because from what I hear, it can take quite a while. Do you want to just kind of share that story with us?
Yeah, so, okay, just a second here. Back in 2017, I believe it was, my husband and I applied for a bison hunt, and we applied together for a few years in a row, and we never really weren't successful. And then one year I applied by myself, and then I got it. So
nice.
Which was, a lot of people were really surprised, right? Because you hear a lot of people saying, I applied for that draw in that area for 25 years, never get it, right? Mm-hmm. And I do it like 3 years in a row and boom, I get it, right? So I was very fortunate to get that. And so that was, so we get the news in June that I now have a bison tag to go, right? And it's for beginning of a December hunt. And we have a 2 week window to hunt this bison. And so that's different because that's like winter hunting, right?
Yeah, right. That's like something you don't hear. Mostly when people talk about like a hunt, or especially like a backcountry kind of hunt, it's, you know, in the fall, not in the winter. Yeah.
Yeah. So we started, you know, going online. It's like, okay, what does it mean to hunt bison in the winter? Right. And there's been quite a few forums on it already. So there was quite a bit of helpful information out there. And they said, like, you know, it could be plus 5 that week, or it could be minus 32, right? That's Celsius. And that's pretty darn cold. Like minus 32, that's like
frost. That's really cold. Holy crap.
Yeah. So what does that look like? So you have to be prepared to hunt an animal in extreme cold, right? Which I never really had to do before. So that was interesting to try to prepare for that. And, you know, the one thing I learned, you know, if you think you have enough gear, you don't. Okay. You bring more. And we got lucky with our weather. You know, I think that was the coldest night was, for example, maybe minus 20, but it warmed up to minus 12
during still, the day. You're talking Celsius. That's
yeah. And cold. You're out there all day. You're out there all day, right? So the biggest thing was like, okay, balaclavas, the things that you wear over your whole face. I did not bring enough of those, right? So one would get all hard with ice because you're breathing, your moisture from your breath, right? And it would freeze and be uncomfortable and gets cold. So you have to take that off and put another one on, right?
Wow.
So we didn't feel like we still didn't have enough of those, I felt. But anyway, so we did a lot of research about, you know, how to hunt for this animal. And one thing that was interesting is we're going up to this area that after a certain point, there's no motorized vehicles. So you're not, or there's no like trucks. You can bring a Ski-Doo or you can bring a quad, for example, mm-hmm. right? But you're not bringing that truck up into there, right? So you're not road hunting per se for a bison, right? So you had to camp on this airstrip. And it's winter. So can you get your stuff in there? Can you drive up to that spot? Can you get your trailer in there? Right.
Yeah.
So we had a small Bigfoot trailer that my dad lent me. And we brought a wall tent because we're thinking in our mind, okay, we're going to be here for like a week. Right. So let's make sure we're prepared. Right.
Did you bring a stove as well?
Yeah. Yeah. We brought a wood stove for sure and had that in the wall tent. And so that was really handy. We had, so even though with my draw, my husband came with me and one of our friends, so that, you know, once I harvested the animal that, you know, we had people to bring it out, right? So we had the trailer and we had the wall tent, which was really helpful. And there is I can't remember it anymore, but it's in the Sicani Chief area in northern BC.
Is it pretty mountainous there or?
Yeah, it's mountainous and there's a lodge there. So what a guide outfitter there. And what he does, he plows from his lodge all the way down to the highway. So we had that, we could get up to our airstrip, no problem. That's where the gate is. And so we managed to like tuck in there with no issues. So that was good. And the snow wasn't really deep on the airstrip, which was really handy because otherwise you don't know where you're going to put your trailer.
What's the deepest like the snow was in the area when you were out
there? Probably some of the mountain sides, like probably past my knee, but on the airstrip itself, it was only maybe a foot and a half deep.
Okay.
So that was easy for the vehicles to get in and out, right? So in one of our, when we were preparing for this trip too, we wanted to talk to somebody on one of these forums to give us advice. So before the hunt all started, so this happened probably, you know, July or August, we talked to somebody that was willing to talk to us about how to be successful for this bison hunt, right? So we were really appreciative that he took the time for us to talk to us. And one thing he did say that really sticks with me or stuck with me is like, it's like, you're going to see, you know, horse manure out there. And you're going to think it's bison and you're going to see tracks and it's going to look like bison tracks, but they're unshod horses. Mm. So don't get tricked by that.
So wild horses or?
No, they're from the ranch.
Okay.
From the guide outfitters, but they turn them loose in the winter. And some say they do that to, trick other hunters. I don't know if that's the case or not, but it is funny because it did trick us, right? Like I worked on a ranch when, years ago. So I'm like, oh, I know what horseshoes, like, I know what horse prints look like. I know what horse poop looks like. So no problem. Right. So, you know, our first day of hunting, you know, we're on our snowmobile and our friends on the quad and we're driving to find tracks of a bison that we can go hunt, right. And get off and do our walk and stalk, hopefully. Right. you know, we come across, you know, this manure and all these tracks. We're like, oh, it's bison, right? Like, well, no, is it or is it horse? I'm like, well, I know what horse is, right? But what got me, I think, was like summer horse poop is different from winter horse poop. Mm. So that's where it got me anyway. So we spent like 3 days hunting around this area that was just actually horses. So we're like, oh man, like this is, well, at least the weather is good, right? And eventually this guy, you know, we saw this guy pass us, a group of three, and they're on their snowmobiles and they go past us, right? A couple hours later, they're coming back with a bison. Oh. Right? And we're like, how did you, what, you just go, you just drove down the valley this first day and you're coming back with one?
Yeah.
So we're like, oh, man. And he's like, yeah, what you're looking at are horse tracks. And we're like, you know? So we learned a lesson, you know, thank goodness we didn't have to learn it too late in the hunt, right? So, and you got to remember the days are quite short, right? In December, I think, you know, you leave in the dark and you're typically coming home in the dark, but to your camp in the dark and it's 9 o'clock. I think you're, you know, 9 o'clock when you can kind of really see, but it gets dark at like 3:30, right? So it's a very short window that you have to hunt these animals, right? Yeah.
What about the temperatures though? Like, were you just suffering all day or were you like, when you kept moving, were you fine?
Yeah. Yeah. When you're traveling on the machines, you could get very cold, but what we did, like we layered up here and snow goggles really help to keep the wind out of your eyes. So snow goggles, what is a must out there. Your knees and your hands got really cold. So we would carry these backpacks and it had extra gloves, extra toques, hand warmers, for example, right? An extra change of clothes as well. So that was kind of like important to have. We'd have a hot thermos of soup every morning, like to bring with us. And so we just make sure that we could always stay warm, right? And then when you're walking, of course you warmed up, but you don't want to sweat because you cool down when you stop, right? But overall, like I said, we got really lucky with the weather. On average, it was -8, -12, which is not too bad, actually, especially if you're moving.
Were you able to get the first one you saw? Or?
Yeah. So we're allowed to have like we got one bison and, I think it happened on day six, I believe, because we had to leave the next day we left, right? So I think it happened on day six. And what happened on day five, we're driving down the valley, and it's a long valley. On the left-hand side is the river, the Sicani Chief River, and on the right-hand side are the mountains, right? And every single day as you're going out there, you know, I'd just be looking up and, oh, okay, stop. I think there's something on the mountain, right? You bring out binoculars and you see elk. Elk are dotting the mountainside everywhere, right? So, but every time you look, you hope it's a herd of bison, right? Yeah. But on the forums, what often the bison like to do is cross the river to the other side. And the other side, it was our hunting area, but how do you get across the river, for example, right? So you're just hoping that they're on this side in the valley. And after we talked to that one guy, he basically said to us, like, just drive down the valley. You know, you'll find fresh sign if they're in the valley, right? But you won't have to just keep just like going off every little trail, just keep driving down this valley. So we took his word for it and we're driving down this valley. And it was a little bit precarious at times because you're crossing some creeks on the machines. At one time, you're like going, there's a creek side on the left-hand side of you. And like, it's just a little tiny passageway to get your machine, right? So sometimes like, okay, I'm just going to get off and just walk, right? Because if you go in, I'm not going to go in with you kind of thing, right? So we made it to this one field. And okay, now there's bison sign. Now I actually see bison poop. I'm like, okay, this is what that looks like, right? So we had a big learning lesson that day and literally we're probably, you know what? They probably heard our machines and moved off.
Yeah.
Right. So we're like, so we tried a little bit further down, didn't see anything. So the next, we made a plan, right? We said, okay, we're going to come back to this area, but we're going to park, you know, a kilometer 2 kilometers, I believe, we parked before that field, and we walked in, right? And you know what's kind of, what was really nice is that there was nobody else camping on the airstrip with us. See, sometimes in October or November, there's draws, and they're for 2 week periods, and a lot of people like that October, November draw because typically there might not be any snow, right? Yeah. So you can have, for example, 10 camps on that airstrip. And every morning, everybody's going out there. We call it, or the one guy called it a metal migration. Mm. You know, everybody's getting on their quads and driving out, right? So we were kind of fortunate. Like, we kind of had this place to ourselves. Like, we know the ranch is over there somewhere, right? And there might be somebody coming in, but we pretty much had the place to ourselves. So we managed to leave that morning and get to our location in the dark, and we started walking in. And there's kind of like the field, just before the field, there's this trail off to the right, and it goes between the field and the mountains. So my husband decided, like, he's going to take that trail. If there's any bison in there, he can radio us, right? Saying that, okay, there's bison up on the mountain, or there's bison on the trail. I'm going to push him towards you, right? So he went there, and me and my friend, we kept walking down this other trail, and we get into the field, and there's a herd of bison there.
How many, right? Are we talking roughly?
Oh, we're probably talking about 150 bison.
Wow.
There was quite a few.
Got to be quite the sight.
Yeah, it was, right? And you're like, you kind of freeze and you start to kind of get that, I call it like buck fever, right? You're like, oh, here's my opportunity. If they spook, they're going to run. Like, how do I do this? And, you know, during the forums and everything, they say, well, this is a herd animal. You can't just, you got to be aware of the animal behind the animal.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you shoot and you can go into another animal, or can go through the bison, which is very unlikely because their hide is so thick and everything. But you got to be aware of that, right? And they even say, like, your instinct is to shoot into that herd and get one, right? But they're like, don't do that, right? So, but it's really true. Like, you get that pull, right? You're like, oh, you just want to bring up your gun and start blasting away and hope one falls, right? That's, so we've been warned about that. And I can just see myself, like, wanting to do that, right? Got to be, you want to be an ethical hunter, so you got to calm down. So me and my friend had to make a plan, right? And so now, because of where they were, and because the snow is deep over there at that, like, out in the tree area, so we were quite like over your knees in snow. So well, we got to kind of stay to the left, you know, and get behind these trees, use a tree as a rest to shoot, right? So we kind of like, we did formulate this plan, and so we got low to the ground and kind of like started crawling, you know, trying to stay as low as we could. And now we're still partly visible now, right? So we're taking a gamble here, right? So as we're getting a little closer, one of them looks up. And it's like, we wait.
How far were you away at this point?
So this one's probably maybe 200 yards away,
okay.
Right? That was one of the first ones, right?
And was it hard to stay quiet in all that snow?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, especially if you're 200 yards away and there's some wind. And
yeah, but it's kind of like still in that valley a bit. So maybe. Actually, just before we got there too, we kind of decided, like, when we're looking at the animals or binoculars, because there were so many in the front, like, we didn't want to shoot there. So we had to pick one that was kind of like by itself, right?
Mm-hmm. And there kinda was this, like, larger one. How lions would do it, right? When they're singling out animals in a herd, like, they look for the lonely ones or the weaker ones and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. So we said, well, what we can do is we can get to these trees and kind of make a better plan of which one we're going to shoot. But if anything happens, we're going to shoot at this far one that's standing by itself, right? And at that time, I kind of like had tunnel vision. I mean, that bison seems so much closer, right? And I said, but, you know, we'll get there and maybe they'll start moving, walking. We can single out another one, right? There's like, at the moment, there's no rush. Like, let's just be calm and let's just focus, right? So as we're approaching the area that we want to go to, I hear a snowmobile.
Oh no.
Right? Yeah. And it's like, this snowmobile is coming down the valley. If he gets in, they're going to scare these bison away. Right. So now I'm kind of freaking out a bit. Right. How close? I see this sounds like they're not too far away from us. Right. And I confirm with my buddy, like, do you hear that? He says, I hear that. Right. It's like, oh, no. You know, it's going to ruin everything. Right. So it's like, we have to move a little bit faster. Right. So we start crawling a little bit more. And next thing you know, the bison's looking up at us again. Right. Like, oh, like, don't move. You know, to that bison, what we look like are wolves.
Yeah.
Crawling in the snow.
Absolutely.
Right? So, you know, it puts its tail up and it warns the others. Now it's like the wave. Like, you got bison running, more run and more run. They're all running to the back now. I'm like, oh, right?
Oh, no.
Kind of freaking out, right? So, you know, we jump up and run to the tree and sit back down, right? And I'm like, okay, well, just pick that one in the back, right? And so it's like, I'm going to shoot and then you shoot, right? Because he's going to be my backup. We want this thing to go down, right? And so I load my gun. I have a clip, right? So it's like, bang, right? And he shoots one and I shoot, and it's not going down, right? It's like, we're just going to keep focused on this one until it goes down, right? And even despite all these other animals are running, this one's just still standing there, right? So, like,
was it a bigger bison?
Yeah, it was a bigger bison. Yeah, for sure. And he was just still standing there. And all of a sudden, my buddy's not shooting. I'm like, how come you're not shooting? He's like, my gun's frozen up.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so his gun is frozen, and that's another thing that they warn you about, right? Your gun could freeze out there, so make sure it's covered. And his was covered, but when we were crawling, some of the snow got inside and got into the mechanism. So when it got exposed to the air, and when he shot, it kind of refroze everything. So it was kind of like up to me now, right? So, you know, I emptied my clip just like that. I'm like, and he's still standing there. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I grabbed my other clip that in, and, you know, and I think it was like my last shot. So I had six shots. My last shot, it took off. I know I hit it, right? So I'm like, but he didn't bring him down, right? So it's like, oh no. So they all move into the back, and now I'm just waiting. Okay. I have more ammo, but it's back at the snowmobile. My buddy's gun is frozen. And so, but my husband's out there, right? And so I'm trying to radio him, right? Like, you know, I hit one, you know, you should move, you know, come towards me. Let's make a plan, right? But their radios aren't working.
Crazy.
So he doesn't know this. And what he is, he walked around the field on the trail, and he's on the other side, and he's face to face with these bison that want to continue down this trail.
Oh my God. So the bison were coming at him basically?
Yeah. So they stopped, they saw him, and he's looking at them. Right. And they're looking at him, and they're like, oh, what do we do now? Right. He's like, you know, could almost reach out and pet one kind of thing. That's how close they were.
Wow.
So he just got,
Was he not freaking out? I would have been freaking out.
Well, he was like, you know, he's like, well, I heard six shots and one is probably down. I can't do anything because I'm not, you know, I don't have the tag, and there's probably one down, you know. Jen's a good shot. She would have brought one down. So he just got to have this time to enjoy these animals. Right. So he just loved just have that opportunity with them. Eventually they just turned, instead of walking, they just went into the forest. Right. There's a kind of a hill, little mountainside, and they just went into the forest and took off. Right. So he waited until everything was clear. And then he started walking into the field up towards us. And he's like, there's no bison out here. What the heck? Ooh. Right. Yeah. So we walked towards him and we met up. He's like, kind of told him the story. Right. And the thing is, no snowmobile ever came.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask whatever happened to that.
Yeah. What we found in that valley, the noises can bounce off the mountains, right? So it was very deceiving. So no snowmobile ever came. It's probably on another road or something, right? So that's another thing that we learned about that hunt. So I said, no snowmobile ever came. And so I was like, okay, now we have to go track a wounded animal, right? Yeah. And hopefully, you know. So as they were, him and Matt started walking down towards, I said, I shot it. And we were kind of walked there all together. And I was just, they found the blood trail before I did. So they started going in for it right away.
That was
away.
Probably pretty easy with all the snow. You probably saw the blood pretty well.
Exactly. And my husband was pretty encouraged because there were quite a bit on the snow, right? He's like, it looks like a really good shot, right? So, and I'm just kind of pattering behind. I don't have any ammo. He has the ammo. So I let him go first, right? And
probably smart because those things get pretty dangerous, I assume, if you're wounded like that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Got to have some ammo on you at least.
Well, talk about dangerous. Yes, exactly. Because he, Matt saw it first. He's like, you know, it was in the trees, not too far from where I shot it, but it was still standing. But it was probably 100 yards in the bush from where I shot it. And it was standing there and you know, there was a lot of blood coming out of its nose and mouth, right? And it was just huffing and puffing when it saw, right? And my husband's wearing this bright yellow jacket, so he just saw him, right? And he's just stomping.
No way.
Yeah, he was just stomping the ground and just like huffing and puffing. So Gay just brought up his rifle and finished it off, right? And he got it in the neck and it just kind of bucked a few times and then fell down, right? Yeah. So we did get our bison. There was a lot of, you know, probably a few mistakes that, you know, were done, but in the end we learned a lot from it. And, you know, now we can pass that knowledge on to others too, like what not to do, what gear to bring, right? What to expect, you know? And, you know, it was quite the large bison. We guesstimated it was about a 5-year-old bull.
Nice.
Right? Yeah. And we got probably about, what was it? Close to 500 pounds of meat off of it.
Jesus Christ, that's so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of an interesting animal because they have a lot of meat, but like if a really large moose will kind of have more. Because a bison, what you think about, they actually have these really large chest cavities. They're huge, their chest cavities.
Yeah.
And they got this small little hind legs actually compared to the rest of the body. Like a moose has way more, for example, on their hind legs. And the hump on their back of the bison is like mainly bone actually, right? So there's a lot of meat, but I would say that there's probably more meat on a moose.
Did you butcher it yourself or did you bring it somewhere?
Yeah, we butchered ourselves.
Okay, yeah. So that's interesting because the hump, I never thought about that. So is that, do you get meat from that area at all? Or is it, you said it's some, it's mostly bone, but there's still some meat there?
Yeah, they got like the, it's a spine and they got these large radiating bones out of it. So you can just get the meat from around those.
Around it. So it's more like scraps and trimmings, or do you get like
egg? Yeah, roast? I would have to say.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like, it's not pure meat, right? So, but it's like kind of like that neck meat, I guess. So that's what your trimmings and hamburger meat, maybe. Yeah.
Cool. And did you take any of the like organs? I assume since they have the chest cavity, that big one, they probably have a pretty big heart and liver and whatnot.
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't remember. I remember we took the liver and I don't remember taking the heart, which I'm kind of maybe I'm a little bit upset about because I've been trying to get into more organ meat, like at least a heart. My grandmother loves liver, right? Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I don't remember if I grabbed that or not. But that's something, you know, in the future, heart, liver, caul fat,
yep.
for example, yep. right? Getting more of those other products from the animal, right?
Yeah.
I think there was just so much going on. It's like, you know, now you have to, it is the morning, but you have to, we wanted to keep the hide. So we were very careful about how we took the hide off. Right. And then to get it back to camp. So it took us like all day. We're going home. We're going back in the dark again. Right.
So how did you get it out? Did you keep, you gutted it out there or did you drag? I mean, you can't drag that thing out by yourself, right? You had to like use some sort of machinery or the snowmobile.
Exactly. So we got Matt to walk back to the snowmobile and pick it up while my husband and I worked on the animal. And he came back with the snowmobile and the skimmer, right? So when we got back, we just kind of, what we did, we ended up kind of, we didn't debone the animal per se. Like we just left the rib cage there. But we took the rest pretty much. We just took the quarters off and everything and put it in the skimmer, then put the hide in, and then we made our long, long journey back to camp. We're probably at least, 30 kilometers down from camp.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, that's a good chunk.
Yeah.
So what do you have to do? Is it difficult with the hide? Do certain cuts you have to make if you want to keep that?
No, it's just like kind of, I would say, skinning a moose. But I think what it is there's so much more fur, I guess, especially in the upper areas. So it's a little, it would dull your blade quite quickly, actually.
Yeah, hair.
So make sure you bring. Yeah. Yeah. So make sure you bring, a knife sharpener. But we went around the face too. We wanted to keep the face. So we took extra care about how we were going to do that. And we even went all the way down to the hoof, right?
Cool.
So it took probably a good 2 hours to properly skin that animal out so we could keep it.
You were probably still so full of adrenaline that you didn't care too much about the cold there.
No. And again, it was actually kind of a decent day. I think that day got down to around -8, and we're in our gear, so we're comfortable. One big thing that at the end, though, is all our gloves got soaked, right?
Ooh,
in the snow
and
working. It is. And now you're going to be traveling back in the dark, and the temperature is starting to drop, right? So it's going to get down to -15. So your hands are wet. So that's where those extra gloves in our packs came in really handy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So we just did a quick change, and we're relatively good to go back home, right?
That's my least favorite thing to happen, ice fishing. I'll put down my gloves. I'm like, God damn it. I just put them into right next to where I drilled the hole. So it's soaked. But yeah.
Yeah. I've done that so many times too, right? It's like, why? You think you would learn by now, but you don't, right? You just want to get fishing, right?
Yep, exactly. Man. Yeah. So were there any maybe emotionally or mentally challenging parts? I mean, I can only imagine. You said you got the bison probably on the last day. You know, you might have the whole time, were you maybe thinking that maybe we don't get one at all? Was that a concern for you?
Yeah. You know, by day five, we got two more days left. You know, are we gonna find them? Like, how easy that guy found them, right? And are we just gonna run into more horses, for example? And you know, you're kind of watching. You don't really know what the weather is going to do. There's no cell service up there, right?
Yeah.
So it was kind of like mentally that way. And I think one of the challenges for me was we bought a snowmobile for this trip, right? And I'm not a snowmobiler, right? Kind of thing. And it was more of a workhorse one. It's not one of the little racing machines, right? It's a workhorse machine, right? And the biggest thing about being on that snowmobile that I found was when you turn, you got to turn a certain way or that snowmobile tips on you. Right. And so it's meant for a two person. So that was always a concern of mine because it's three times it tipped on us. Right. And you're worried about being injured so far away.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, at that time I didn't have an in-reach Garmin. So if you got hurt, who knows about it? Right. So it was just after that, I said, okay, if you're going to turn, I'm just going to get off, just make it easier. Right. Because what those sleds do, they really like to have regular trails, not to be in snow. Right. Mm. You need to have a lot of power to go through that soft snow to turn. Right. So that was kind of like a learning lesson for us. So it's just there were some tense moments, I think, between my husband and I, you know, you can just stay on. I'm like, no, let me off. Right. And you know, it's like, okay, I want to go here. I want to go there. Right. It was actually overall kind of an easygoing trip. I mean, that's part of hunting. You're exploring, you're scouting. It's nice if you come across something, but you're not expecting it. So overall, the group was pretty good. And, I'm really hopeful to that last bitter end, right? Until I'm in that truck leaving, I'm always hopeful. And even when on the way back out to the highway, I'm still hoping to see something, right? It's not until I hit that highway where I have given up all hope, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
But, Yeah, exactly. So overall, it was great, a great experience. You know, every night was clear. Like every night we saw the moon come up. Every night we saw the stars. Wow. Every morning we saw a sunrise, you know, It was absolutely breathtaking out there, right? And one time we're on top of a mountain, you know, checking this one spot out, and you can actually see like a storm come in, right? And you're like, is that going to hit us? You know, and it's just these massive black clouds coming, and then it just goes on by, you know? And so we kind of missed that, right? So just every day we got to see some amazing scenery. Every day we got to see elk, which were just, it was fun to see them, right?
I love
that. The guys were always, how can you see that elk on those mountains? Like they can't, they just look like little dots. I'm like, oh no, no, there's animals up there, right? So that was just really fun to watch. Oops. Yeah, it was a good experience. And you know, it really prepared us for a hunt that took place 2 years after that, or the year after. Yeah, 2 years. Our buddy Matt, the one that we went with, he ended up getting a bison draw. Second time he put in.
Wow.
Go figure, right? So him and my husband went out to the same area, right? And now they knew what to expect, and they ended up getting their bison. Mm. So,
Were they successful faster?
Yeah. I think they got theirs on day three. And pretty much what happened was they were told, like they found out that bison crossed the river. And, oh, no, no, no. So what they are, they went to the Sicani Chief Lodge, the outfitters, because there was a problem with the equipment that they had. So they had to go to the outfitters, and they're just like rented the rooms there, and they went up for hunts, and they heard it through one of the people at the outfitters that the bison went across the river. And my husband can see that they've taken snowmobiles across the river. So he's like, I can do this too. So he takes a snowmobile, and he gets halfway across the river, and he doesn't make it.
No.
Yeah. So they had to get the snowmobile out. I know I never asked about how they got it out of the river, but it got back to the ranch, and now the fuel line's full of water.
Oh my God.
So now they don't have a snowmobile. So what ended up happening is that they went up to, you know, one of the guides that worked there. They're like, can you be our guide? Because we need machines, right? So they end up hiring the guide, and the guide's like, okay, yeah. So they went out the first day. They saw bison, but they couldn't make a good shot, right? And a good ethical shot. So they decided not to go for it. But the next day they went to another spot, right? And they were just kind of waiting, overlooking this field, and out come six bison. And so there was like five young bison and a large bison. So they picked the largest one. So it was kind of nice to have some of that bison meat for, you know, a couple years in a row.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you get, I'm guessing you gave some to your friend when you got yours, and he maybe gave you guys some of his.
Yeah, exactly. That's how we kind of partner up. Right. So we kind of increase our chances that way, you know. It's like, you get a draw, we'll help you. We get a draw, we help you. Yeah, and we can all share the meat. Yeah. Yes. So hopefully we'll try again this year. And his wife actually got a bison draw.
Oh no.
For last year.
You guys are lucky. Holy crap.
Yeah, we were, our group has been amazingly fortunate, actually. I should be buying lotto tickets or something, but hey, I'll take this any day. Right.
Right.
However, just because of circumstances, we weren't able to go out this year to harvest her bison, or help her harvest her bison. So unfortunately, my husband is due. He's due for a draw. So we're going to keep our fingers crossed.
So what happens if that, like, do you get another tag if you can't use it like that? Or is it just bad luck and then you got to restart from the beginning?
Actually, once you get a tag here, you're at reduced odds for 3 years.
Mm.
That happens with moose and bison. Actually, next year I'll be back in the clear. Like, I'll be back at full odds again, right? Whereas Matt and his wife will be at reduced odds for a couple more years to come.
Cool. What I was going to ask you, did you see any predators out there? Any sketchy predator, like bear? I don't know. Do you guys have bear, wolf, I'm assuming?
Yeah. Well, the bears are hibernating. Grizzlies can come out of hibernation anytime they want, right? So you still have to be aware of that. Whereas there was lots of wolf tracks.
Mm.
Yeah. So that kind of just did make me a little bit nervous for sure, right? About the wolves.
Yeah. Especially if you're hunting something that they also hunt, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they hunt some bison, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, and then now you have all this meat. What are some of your, like, what's your favorite? Do you have one favorite meal to make with bison?
Oh, I mean, just a good old bison steak was just awesome, right? On the barbecue, you can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had that. I've mostly had just ground bison is what I've had. And that's farm-raised. I've never had wild.
Yeah, well, it tastes so, I guess, so similar, I guess, because, I mean, even farm bison, I believe, are fed just grasses, right?
Most of the time.
So they are probably very similar. On our bison, there was actually quite a bit of yellow fat, and the yellow fat's from that bit of carotene that's in the grasses. So that was really nice, rich fat to eat.
That's what you want to see in, like, a grass-fed cow and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. And my bull had quite a bit, actually. So it was really nice to see that. What else did I like? Making beef dips, except you make bison dips. That was pretty fantastic.
Can you elaborate on that one a bit? About what you mean by dips? Like,
so you take like a bison roast, right? And then you slow cook it. And then you take a strip, the drippings, and you make a broth out of it.
Ah, okay.
Right. And then so then you take it like a bun and you put your bison meat in the middle and then you dip it in the broth.
Wow. That sounds really, really good. I've never heard of that.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah, no, it was one of our favorite things to make because it's so flavorful. Right.
Yeah.
And that broth is just so nice. And you typically add you can add like some beef bouillon to it or other herbs and spices to flavor that broth. Mm. Right. And that's really good to do with the tougher cuts of the bison, the tougher roasts, I mean. So it's just one really great way to use it. Bacon or wrap, filet mignon. Got to do that, right? Last night I took some of the stew meat and cooked it up and actually made bison enchiladas last night.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's got to be great. So are you still eating on that one bison that you got?
No, that would have been Matt's bison from 2 years ago. Yeah, it's really like bottom of the barrels. I think there's like two or three cuts left, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes that happens. Like you get, some meat and then you put other meat on top and you put other meat on top. So that was kind of happening with us.
Yeah.
We're not rotating it properly, but at least it wasn't freezer burnt. So we were okay.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Wow. Well, that was a really exciting story about your bison hunt. You should definitely write that up in a blog post, I think, because I think you said you wanted to do that still.
Yeah, because I think it's just so neat that, it's different. It's different to hunt a herd animal and not to take that first instinct and shoot and try to formulate a plan, right? And then, you're going to have could be equipment malfunctions and stuff, right? So, and it was just an amazing, amazing trip. I'm looking forward to doing it again, that's for sure. And it's just so neat to see, to see a female go get a bison too, right?
Yeah.
That's even less common than people. That's even less common. Yeah.
Did you guys have a nice celebration after?
Oh yeah, for sure. As much as we could, we were pretty bagged.
Yeah,
right?
I bet.
You got to remember, this is your fifth day. You're getting up early, you're going to bed at a decent time, right? But at the same time, you're out in the elements every single day and you're working every day and you're moving every single day. So by the fifth day, so that was the evening of the sixth now, right? And we're leaving tomorrow, right? So definitely a blessing. But we were pretty bagged, right? It was just enough to make our dinner, have a drink, talk about it, and then just kind of pass out by nine kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
we
I cannot
more...
continue. Oh, sorry. Sorry, no, go ahead.
All right, so we definitely did more celebrating when we got home that evening.
I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can only imagine at those temperatures. You're tough. That most hunters are, won't do that kind of stuff. So it's cool. It's cool that you're seeking out that kind of experience.
And I would definitely do that time again, just because there's not so many that apply for that time, right? Mm-hmm. I would be concerned if it was any colder. Like the one guy that we did talk to, like he was hunting in minus 20 degrees Celsius, which is cold, right? I wonder how we would have reacted to those temperatures. I have a feeling we would have not been prepared for those temperatures. So even though I thought we were prepared, right?
Yeah.
So next time, like, you know, you're buying a $100 pair of wool socks, right? You're buying these layers to try to keep warm, right? And, you know, you think you had enough good gear and you're like, no, I should have had more or more layers, you know, if it got down to minus 20.
I'm always amazed at how the people like back in the day used to do this kind of stuff. And you know, they didn't have the fast drying synthetic garments. They all had, you know, the wool garments, the natural garments that are, you know, they have their benefits, but they are heavier. And
yeah.
I mean, once they do get wet, you know, then it's kind of game over.
Right. I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
Cool. Well, last question I have for you. Do you have any advice for women who are interested in getting into hunting? Because as we talked about right at the beginning, like it's just not common, I feel like, for women to hunt. And I think we need to change that, because why not? I mean, it's a it's an activity that everyone can do. And, you know, overall, the wildlife benefits from more hunters, especially here in the U.S., you know, with our system. I'm assuming it's similar with you where you are, that that we, you know, the more we have people buying licenses and spending on ammo and gear and whatnot, the more funding there is for wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's similar here too. Yeah, that hunting is kind of, people don't understand the same, but hunting is conservation.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So I think for women, women are a really high growing demographic in the hunting field, so it's really good to see, but there still comes with challenges, right, with the stereotypes and everything. So I mean, I've been really, you know, blessed with my dad encouraging me and my husband encouraging me. Like, well, he never had to encourage me. Like, you know, he met me, I'm a hunter, so he's a hunter and that's what we do, right? And most of my friends, like even my male friends, have always, they don't mind women being in a group, right? Yeah. And they often say, the women are better hunters anyway, so we got to bring them along, right? So as kind of, I don't know, I really fell into a really great group of people that way, right? But I think for women, for advice, would be like, find your support group, right? Find that support. You know, if your family's not really supporting you, go, you know, be on Facebook and join a forum or a Facebook group for women, and find, you know, those people in your area that you can hook up with, right? And have those discussions with. So, because I think that's kind of important. I don't think I could have done what I do without the support of my hunting group.
Yeah. And that
it's important.
I think that goes for anyone trying to learn how to hunt, you know, mentorship and finding a mentor and just finding other people that are into it is just super valuable. And then you can all communicate about it. And, you know, that person goes scouting and can give you some intel. And then you do the scouting and of a different place. And it all works just better when you communicate like that and hunt as a team almost, I think.
Oh, it totally is. And if you can find a person in your area and say, can you go hunting together? Because like it is a lot of tough work. I mean, the easy part is pulling that trigger, but getting that animal out is tough, right? And yeah. It can be very intimidating to a person, male or female, that has never really done it before, right? So to have that extra set of hands, right, that extra, the mind to how to work an animal and how to get it back to the truck, I think is very helpful, and to get it back home, right? There's a whole process after that. And
yeah,
I think
that's where most of work is afterwards.
It is. And I think that's the biggest part of the support we need. Like a woman could walk out there and find her animal and shoot it, but what happens afterwards?
That's a good point.
So much more involved afterwards. That's what I find the biggest part of it, right? You know, and some ladies like, I want to go out there, but I'm intimidated. I don't want to walk in the bush, right? By myself. I'm too scared, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, this may be taboo to some hunters, but I say, then don't go walk in the bush. go for a drive, road hunt, right? Do what you're comfortable with. If you find an animal, great, right? And then your lease, you're nearby your truck, you know, you feel safe and secure, right? And maybe getting that animal to your truck would be more tangible, right? More realistic, right? So start off small. You've got to go from somewhere. You got to start from somewhere and gain that confidence over time, right? It doesn't just happen overnight. So you can take baby steps. And if you need to road hunt, then road hunt, right?
Yeah. And even if you're road hunting, you know, you still have all that work afterwards, and that gives you plenty. You know, some people might want to hunt. It's becoming more and more, I feel like, because they want to reconnect with nature and they want to connect with their food. So even if you are road hunting, you might not get the most primal experience, but you're still, you know, making tons of connections with nature along the way, especially after, once you harvest the animal and have to butcher it and process it into food and whatnot.
Yeah, you're gaining connections and you're gaining experience, right? You know, there was a time when I'd never go out by myself or walk down a trail by myself, right? But over the years, I got, you know, I took baby steps, and now, you know, I'm pretty confident to leave my truck behind and go for a walk,
yeah,
right? But it takes time. And so other hunters have to remember that and like give other hunters grace and encouragement, right? Sometimes we're like, you know, you road hunt, you're not a hunter kind of thing, right? You know, the definition of hunting is to procure the pursuit of an animal, right? Even if I'm in a car, I'm pursuing an animal, right? So we've got to give each other some grace and, you know, and not knock each other down, especially for somebody who's learning, right? And being in your comfort zone too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. No, love that. That is great advice. And Jennifer, I really appreciate you being on the show. And, you know, I think we did over 2 hours now, which is awesome. I love the long conversations like these. These are my favorite. And I, you know, this is definitely one of my favorite and most interesting convos, I think. And super actionable advice, especially with birch, you know, people listening, get excited about it. Get out there this year. Even if you just do it like me and you just get maybe a water bottle full, just, you know, it's another thing to add to your list, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, I hope the listeners do go out and get inspired by this. And I just want you to give, like, where can people find you? Because you have, like we said, you have your blog and your Instagram, right?
Mm-hmm. And you can also find me on Facebook, Moose, Martians, and Mud. That's where I'm probably the most active.
Okay.
And so, yeah, just go to my Moose, Martians, and Mud. I post there as often as I can. I mean, I love my blog, but those are more for stories, and I don't have a lot of time to write stories lately, so I'm not as active there, but yeah, follow me on Facebook.
And if someone, you know, living in your area, your region, hears this podcast, wants to maybe do a course with you, are those online then on your website when you do run them, or how does that all work?
Yeah, so I often will post a schedule on my Facebook page.
Okay.
For foraging and nature tours. And they generally start at the in spring. So for around here, that's about May 10th that I'm starting to offer those courses. And I'm just like keep checking my Facebook page to see if I posted anything new and the times, right? But yeah, I take people out, and spring edibles are one of my favorite times to do because there's such a bounty up here for spring edibles. I just love this northern boreal region that we're in. I don't think you'll ever get me off this land here. So yeah, I encourage people to check out my Facebook page and to book a course with me if they can, because it's very, very valuable information.
Oh yeah. And like we've been talking about throughout the episode, the best thing you can do to learn fast and safely is a mentorship. So definitely encourage anyone in the area or close to you to check that out. Maybe I'll have to have you on sometime to talk about those northern boreal forest plants, because that's something, you know, down here it's mostly deciduous. That's kind of what I'm learning now. I'm learning a lot of plants you can find along streams, because we have a ton of trout streams here in this area. And but that's obviously different from areas with a lot of pines and spruce, I'm guessing you have out there and whatnot.
Yeah, true. We definitely have a different set of plants here.
Yeah. Do you have any, just off the top of your head, for those specific, that specific area, do you have like a number one field guide or book or anything for people to to check out. There's a lot on the Midwest and whatnot, but I feel like I haven't seen too much.
No, you know, when it comes to Western, Northern Canada, we don't have a huge amount, but we do. So the edible and medicinal plants of Canada is a decent one. But of course, it's not our area specific. I think a really good one is called the, actually I got it right here a second. The boreal herbal.
Mm.
So that one's like, this is my like number one book here.
Awesome.
You see it. Yeah, that one's really great. I've learned a lot from that book. Yeah, and then there's a Northern British Columbia plant guide. But it doesn't necessarily talk about all the edibles. It will say if a plant is edible, and that's pretty much it. But there's so many more plants in there. So I find that I have to buy multiple guidebooks to kind of gather the information I want. But that's okay. I'll do what it takes to gather my information.
Right. And then also be in those Facebook groups. That's another important thing.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Almost every single town that you live in will probably have its own foraging group, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So join that and they can really help you identify. It's a community, right? It's like, what is this plant? It's this, right? If somebody knows. So very, very super helpful.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'll link all your website and all your social media in the podcast description for people to check out. And yeah, besides that, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed our time.
That's all I have for you today. Hopefully you guys learned as much from Jennifer as I did. I would absolutely love to hear from you if you're planning to add birch to your foraging list this year. Or, you know, honestly, I'm just excited to hear what you guys are all trying to forage for in general. So, you know, go over to Instagram, send me a direct message because I'm really looking forward to engaging in some conversation with you. And if you do get value from the podcast, please subscribe and rate it with a 5-star review. This is really how we can grow the show and bring the message about real food and this awesome outdoor, you know, nature lifestyle to more foodies like you and me. Finally, I'm doing a weekly newsletter now with 3 interesting food-related topics that I learned during the week. So in the newsletter, I basically will be sharing links with you to blog posts, videos, so you can also learn alongside me. And if you want to get on that email list, head over to my website, which is www.theyearofplenty.com. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the podcast. Until next time, my friends, let's keep exploring real food together.